3 weeks into the air war over Ukraine and the battle for air superiority rages on. The Russian Air Force is suffering shocking losses from a combination of poor strategy, a terrible operational plan, inadequate or ineffective doctrine, tactics, and training, as well as execution errors. Ukrainian resistance has been fierce, and Russia does not look like it will establish control of the skies anytime soon. Ukraine has prevented Russia from leveraging their overwhelming numerical advantage in aircraft, thus hindering their air support to the ground invasion. Today, I welcome back Micah Zeus Fessler, a former F-15C, F-16, and F-22 pilot, to discuss the air war so far and answer questions you have about the conflict. This is the Air Minded Podcast. Welcome back, Air Minded listeners. This is your host, Tyson Gorilla Wetzel, with episode 2 of the Ukrainian Air War episodes. In this episode, I welcome back for his second visit, Micah Zeus Fessler. He's a fighter pilot with nearly a quarter of a century of experience flying fighters in the United States Air Force. We talked a lot about the air war so far, but primarily this episode is designed to answer the questions that you had. I put out a simple question on Twitter: what do you all want to hear about with the air war? And we picked some of the questions to answer, and I hope that you get two different perspectives. Me being an intelligence officer and now working at a think tank, and then somebody who's actually flown a bunch of combat missions. So before we get into the actual discussion, as I mentioned in the first episode of the war, that episode was a dispassionate view of the war. Same thing goes for this episode, but that does not mean that either myself or Zeus is dispassionate about the conflict itself, nor the plight of the Ukrainians. I mentioned last time I never really ask anything of the listeners, but if you do want to help the cause of Ukraine or Ukrainians, displaced persons, I have some ideas. You can listen to them. You could research them on your own, or just completely disregard, or forward about a minute or two and you'll get to the interview. So last episode, I brought up the International Rescue Committee at rescue.org, who are helping some of the estimated 3 million Ukrainian refugees. They're excellent. I've given to them. But this episode, I wanted to mention a new organization, Come Back Alive, at comebackalive.in.ua. This is an organization that's been providing necessary supplies to Ukraine since this war kicked off in 2014. A lot of times we just think about the war that's been going on since the 24th of February, but it's worth remembering that Russia invaded Ukraine 8 years ago, and this organization, Come Back Alive, has been supporting the Ukrainians and getting necessary supplies in-country for the last 8 years. But since this is the Air Minded Podcast, I wanted to tell you about two products that are Ukrainian air war focused that you can buy and also help out the cause. I've purchased them both, and I will vouch for both of them. I should mention these aren't sponsored ads. I don't have any sponsored ads. These are just items that I've found and I bought, and I think they're awesome. The first is the Ghost of Kyiv poster at squadronposters.com. If you don't know Squadron Posters, at least in the Air Force and actually in U.S. Military, most people know Squadron Posters. They make unit posters from the old travel postcard style. They're absolutely beautiful. They're awesome. I own one from just about every unit I've ever been in. They made a Ghost of Kyiv poster. It's absolutely gorgeous. I'll put a picture of it on my social media. All the proceeds from those sales go to the UN Refugee Agency. They've already passed over $10,000 donated. The standard poster is $32, and it's great, but I'm telling you, you're going to want to spend a little bit extra and get the canvas wrap. That's the picture I'll post. It's absolutely great. The next, I now wear a suit every day to work, and I like to wear some colorful socks. The sock company Heel Tread at heeltread.com. If you don't know them, they make great socks. Anyways, they make Ghost of Kyiv socks for $11. For each pair they sell, they're sending two pairs to Ukraine, to the people and refugees. They've already donated 2,000 pairs of socks. I bought a couple. They're awesome. Okay, enough of that. Let's get on to the focus of the episode. It's the Ukraine air war. This is going to be the second of, I don't know, we'll see how many episodes. I will release another episode next week with Kelly Grieco. She's a senior fellow with me at the Atlantic Council, and she's a former professor of the U.S. Air Force Air Command and Staff College. She's absolutely brilliant on air power, employment, and history. She's got really strong thoughts on both no-fly zone options and also how this war may be showing us the changing character of war in general. You're going to want to hear her thoughts on the Ukraine air war, so check this space in about a week. But you don't need to wait for that episode. Give her a follow on Twitter. She's at KA_GRIECO. But without further ado, let's get to my conversation with Zeus Fessler. I've known him for a long time. He still calls me by my old call sign, Getter, so don't worry if you hear that. That's me. Zeus feels really strongly about this war. He is really smart on air power employment. I think you're going to want to hear what he has to say. So here you go. My sit down with Zeus Fessler. All right, my guest in this episode is making his second appearance on the Air Minded podcast. It's Micah Zeus Fessler. Zeus flew fighters for more than 20 years in the United States Air Force and Air National Guard. He has more than 2,000 hours in the F-15C Eagle, the F-16 Viper, and the F-22 Raptor. He's flown combat missions over Syria and Iraq. He is commanded at the squadron and wing level. He's incredibly experienced in operational tests and in tactics development, joint operations, planning and flying in an air campaign. But specifically for this episode, he's a Ukraine war junkie. He texts me constantly to talk about what we're seeing in the press, about how the war is going. When I wanted to get into this this conflict a little bit more, I knew Zeus was the right contact. So Zeus, welcome to the Air Minded podcast.
Thanks, brother. It's great to be here. I'm excited to be back.
Okay, so we are recording on Thursday, March 17th, St. Paddy's Day. We're actually both wearing green, not that anybody will be able to see that. But so just to give everybody an idea where we are, this is the 18th day of the air campaign. So before we get into it, Zeus, I'm going to give just a little bit of a brief update of where we are. But actually, before I do that, I know we'll have probably a couple of first-time listeners that have not followed the Air Minded podcast. I'm not going to go through my first question to all of my guests, which is kind of your origin story in the Air Force. There's another Zeus podcast. You know, check it out if you want to learn a little bit more about Zeus's background. But I do always ask what my guest is drinking. What do you have today?
I've got a Guinness because it is St. Patrick's Day.
I have a Guinness in the fridge and didn't think about it until I looked at the little clock on my computer that said March 17th. I actually have I have a bourbon, a Jefferson's Ocean Aged at Sea, which is quite lovely, but a special podcast, I thought, a special liquor. So anyways, let's get into it. Let me give just a brief rundown of the air campaign. The last episode I did was at the 72-hour point, so we've got not quite three more weeks of execution. If I were to put a bottom line up front, it's that the Russians still suck. They are suffering extremely high losses. If you believe the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense, which I don't, they've lost over 80 planes, 100 helicopters, and eight unmanned aerial vehicles. If you follow Oryx on Twitter, and I'll put that in the podcast notes, that individual just counts stuff that he's been able to confirm via video and pictures. It's at least 12 fighters, at least 30 helicopters. I think the answer is somewhere in between. Nonetheless, Russia is suffering huge losses that are likely unsustainable. And I think the reason for that, and this will be my first question to you, Zeus, but I believe that Russia failed to establish air superiority early. They clearly haven't established air superiority. And as a result, they're losing, from their perspective, far too many aircraft. Just big picture, we're 3 weeks in. What have you seen from the air campaign over Ukraine?
No, I think I've seen the same kind of thing. I think I've been pretty surprised. I fully expected them to establish air superiority early. And as I've been watching this, they just haven't really adjusted. Now, part of that is you only get one swing at the bat on night one. I think somebody I know said that just earlier as we were BSing. But you only get one shot at that. And then once your ground force has moved forward and once things have started getting mixed up, that problem gets more and more complicated on a regular basis. And so I think not establishing that early has really put them on their heels. And I think they haven't quite figured how to get themselves out of that.
So I'm with you in that I expected air superiority, the Russians to establish air superiority early. So unlike some of the analysts on Twitter and my takes are all written down in my Atlantic Council writing. So I feel like I've been pretty clear on this. I thought the Ukrainians would do much better than most thought and didn't think the Russians would roll. That said, I was absolutely wrong in my assessment of air superiority, which I thought Russia would gain in 72-ish hours. And my reasons for that is that they have numerical and qualitative, so quantitative and qualitative superiority over the Ukrainian Air Force. They have outstanding aircraft that they have forward deployed. They have some really outstanding precision guided munitions, really robust electronic warfare. they have the components and they had deployed the components to be able to execute a really strong air campaign and almost knock out the Ukrainian Air Force or land that knockout blow on night one. In the last episode, I talked about things that I think they failed to do in the first 72 hours. What are things that you think that they missed in the first 72 hours that is still coming back to bite them?
Well, I think the biggest things were, I believe they kind of assumed it was going to be over quickly, yeah. Right? And so they decided they wanted to keep airfields open. They wanted to leave a lot of infrastructure in place because they were just going to roll in and take that. And if you look at, you know, historically, when you achieve air superiority over a country, you're doing that by taking out their ability not only to fly the airplanes they were flying on night one, but generate further sorties by taking out their ability to shoot at you with surface-to-air missiles. You know, there are all those pieces and parts that I think the fundamental error, if I had to pick one right now, is probably on a miscalculation that this was going to be over in a very short period of time. And so they had a chance to hit the things that would give them air superiority or make it easier to do so, and they failed to do that.
Yeah, I think what we're looking at is failures at the strategic, operational, and tactical level. So what you talked about, I think, is a major strategic error in just not being prepared for the right fight. And even if they thought that was likely to happen, that they'd win in 4 days or whatever, you still have to build in contingency plans. So if that doesn't happen, and nothing is guaranteed, I can't believe that they didn't crater runways, hit aircraft on the ground, take out surface-to-air missiles, take out command and control nodes on night one. That to me, I think right there, that's the original sin. And it becomes more and more difficult. So why do we continue talking about air superiority? You know, the big fight, I think most people that are watching the news or their social media feeds is seeing what's happening in the cities and what the ground forces are doing. But I think you and I probably agree on this, that the lack of air superiority is actually really affecting Russia's ground scheme of maneuver, because they do have hundreds and hundreds of ground attack aircraft and helicopters, or planes and helicopters, that they are not able to leverage optimally to support their ground invasion. So I think that is really slowing their advance, especially in the north, because they don't have air superiority. What do you think the impact of a lack of air superiority has been so far on the Russian scheme of maneuver or operational plan?
I think you hit it right on the head there, but I think you see it actually becoming more challenging for them from a logistics side of the house, right? They are having a hard time resupplying yeah. themselves, and that's because they can't actually protect their LOCs, their lines of communication, their logistics supply routes coming in to support them. And that's fundamentally a function of not being able to see, sense, and attack the enemy around those supply routes. And you can see that with a number of things that are happening, whether that's the TB2s out there knocking out, you know, various vehicles along the highways, or whether the fact that Russians have no idea that they're getting ambushed left and right. And those things are a function of a lack of an overhead view of the battle space and the ability to affect that battle space quickly to protect their logistic supply chain.
All right. Boom. I think that you nailed it right there. So if we were to take the big picture, you know, recap of the air war, it ain't going well for the Russians. I am worried that we take the wrong lessons learned out of this. Obviously, they are underperforming. I don't think we should assume if there is a U.S.-NATO fight, not that we want that at all. We have to assume that they would do better. I do anticipate over the course of this conflict, their tactics will improve. We're already talking about it. We're seeing some things that indicate they're maybe not trying to stay as low to the ground, maybe trying to stand off a little bit more to reduce those losses. I do think their employment will improve. I do also think the Ukrainians are cagey. They're going to get some more missiles. I think the battle for air superiority is not going to be decided anytime soon. If you were to make a prediction on air superiority, is one side or the other going to develop air superiority in the next few weeks or months?
No, but I would put that in a very different perspective than we normally think of it. And this is where I think those stingers are going to become a really big deal over time. The Russians have a pretty limited supply of precision guided munitions. And you can see this. They're advanced fighters. One, they're using frog feets. That's what I prefer to call them when there's multiples. But they're using their older attack planes, they're using attack helicopters, and even their modern stuff is dropping dumb bombs. And to put a dumb bomb in the right place, you're going to put yourself in the envelope for a Stinger to knock you out of the sky. And I think just merely the proliferation of Stingers into that country are going to help the Ukrainians sustain a contested airspace over their country for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. And to that point, they have relied a lot on some of their older frames, but their most advanced and most capable air-to-ground platform is the Su-34 fullback, the angry platypus, if you will. There's already confirmed 4 losses of that aircraft. That would be if we lost, you know, 4 Strike Eagles. That is a pretty significant loss. I know 4 doesn't sound like a ton, but that's a big loss. And you're losing the air crew, you know. So anyways, about a week ago, I put out on my Twitter feed some requests of questions. And actually, I thought that should drive our conversation because we got some really good questions. So I wanted to tee most of these up to you. So obviously, you're the aviator here. So a lot of them are going to be towards you. I'll answer a few of the intel questions. I do want to point out just one more time that both of us are – this is all, everything we're going to tell you about is from open source information, no classified information, not leveraging anything. It's all open press that you and anybody else can find. And the other thing is, as military officers, we're not taking a position one way or the other on what the U.S. should do or NATO should do in terms of further action. We're going to be talking about feasibility of options. We're going to be talking about what different systems could do against the Russians, but none of this should be taken as advocacy in any way. So with that disclaimer put out, let's go ahead and get into the Q&A. So the first question that I have for you, Zeus, is I believe the way he pronounces it is Joel Postma. I'm sure that's not how he pronounces it. I screwed it up. He's one of the most loyal listeners and followers on Twitter. And I'm sorry, I just butchered your name. He's a Royal Netherlands Air Force officer. He's a grad of the School of Advanced Air and Space Power Studies, or SAS, which is our premier air education program. He's a really brilliant air power theorist himself. He asks, have Western air forces mischaracterized the development of Russian air power? And why are we so surprised by their lack of effectiveness? Zeus, both you and I have said we thought Russia would establish air superiority. And we kind of hinted on it. But to get to Joel's question, why were we so wrong? Is it employment or is it just a bad Air Force?
So I'm going to go back to kind of what we talked about a little bit earlier. And I cannot, I think, overstate the importance of the potential strategic failure. I might give you some grief here and tell you it's an intel failure for Russia. That's a joke. But the reality of this is they thought that they were going to roll this thing up in a very short period of time. And so what I would say is that it's really early for us to do the postmortem on this one, to figure out exactly what happened. And we have to be very careful about what we take away from it. But at the same time, If you think you're going to have a few day, and if you look at what happened in Georgia and you look at what happened in Crimea in 2014, the idea that they can go in and make things happen in a very short period of time, call it good, the world will eventually back off, forget about it, move on to the next crisis. I think there's a strategic failure that has led them down a operational and a tactical path here that we have to take into account, or that we definitely need to be thinking about. That doesn't mean that there aren't tactical failures here, and that the fact that they have not adjusted their game plan at this point in time is indicative of some operational failures on the planning side, or the flexibility, which is the key to air power. But I have to always try and frame things in, okay, how did they think this was going to go down, and did they apply their air power the way we expect them to? And so far, I don't feel like they've applied their air power as we expected them to, or as they have traditionally done.
So his follow-up question is, what does that mean for our capability development? You spent a lot of time in operational tests and developing new capabilities. I'll give you my short answer. I feel like we're on the right track in terms of how we're fighting both today and with the platforms that we're developing for the future. I haven't seen really anything that I think we need to change in our capability development. Is there something you've seen specific to this war that you think might merit another look, or maybe some new capability we need to be thinking about?
I don't. And I'll give you a couple of reasons for that right off the bat. The first of those is there's always two camps that I've seen in arguments, right? There's the camp that makes everything 10 foot tall and bulletproof, and there's the camp that says they can't do anything. And I tend to fall in between those two, right? Somewhere in the middle is the reality of our adversary. And I think that's, I haven't changed that perspective looking at this fight. I think the other important thing, and it, you can rewind, this is something you can find from our national security, you know, strategy, our national defense strategy, going backwards. But remember, China is the pacing threat. Russia is a peer competitor, right? But we still are building and thinking about what we do in relation to China. And we, when crises come up, you have to remember your strategy, your game plan, the focus that you have, and not take your eye off that ball, because a strategy not followed is ineffective every single time. And I think that's a kind of an important thing to think about here. And to your point that you just said a minute ago, the path that we're on is the right path vis-a-vis China, and quite frankly, the right path vis-a-vis Russia's equipment that for some reason we're not seeing them bring into the fight in full force at the high end completely, and in the normal way that we have seen them train and expect them to do so in the past. And I think that framing of this discussion says, stay, you know, hold the stick in place, freeze the stick, let everything, you know, figure itself out here. Let's do the postmortem on this afterwards and figure out what the future looks like. But the reality is that I don't want to take my eye off of China in this scenario.
That's a really, really good point. One of the things that I have seen is, and I'm waiting out of the air power debate, but I really think what I have taken out of this is you don't necessarily need to respond to a big armored invasion with a big armored force. So I don't think outnumbering the mechanized force that Russia can present against NATO is maybe the way to go. I think what we've seen is good intelligence on the battle space and good use of things like TB2 is really effective. I hope that we're sending the Switchblade kamikaze drones. We mentioned that there's some sort of tactical UAV that is, or UAS, that unmanned aerial system that's being sent out with this new $800 million of security assistance. And people are speculating it's the Switchblade. I think if people don't know what that is, it's a very small tactical unmanned system that carries a very small improvised explosive device. Okay, at James D. Schmidt asks, and I group these all together because it's a lot about what we're learning about Russia's kind of ineptitude. James D. Schmidt asks, why is the TB2 Bayraktar racking up kills, including on surface-to-air missile systems or SAMs? Have we been wrong that legacy assets can operate in a near-peer fight? So let me start, and then I'm going to hand it over to you. A lot of people, myself included, have thought that non-low observable or non-stealthy unmanned aerial vehicles or UAVs, things like the MQ-1 Predator that is now out of U.S. service and the MQ-9 Reaper, would not be survivable in a high-end fight against maybe our pacing threat of China or against Russia. Some people are looking at the TB-2, which is fairly comparable to the Predator Reaper, as being survivable, as destroying a ton of armor, and even destroying surface-to-air missiles that should be killing the UAV. So why is TB-2 so effective? I want to get rid of any belief that this is a stealthy UAV, or because it's small, it can't be seen by radar, or it flies too slow, or anything like that. A good SAM operator would be able to find this thing. I have no doubt of that at all. What I think we're seeing is poor employment of these surface-to-air missiles and a lack of air superiority and developing a localized integrated air defense system. So as the surface forces move forward, as the ground forces move forward, they have mobile radars, they have mobile command and control systems, and they have mobile SAMs. They should set up a localized IADS within the border of Ukraine to protect their ground forces, and they're not doing that. When we see a TB2 destroying an SA-11 or an SA-17, that SA-17 shooter has probably got three of his buddies within very close proximity. One of them needs to be up and it radiating and shooting down that TB2. To me, that's really piss poor operational employment or tactical employment of that airframe, or excuse me, of that SAM. So I don't change my perspective that MQ-9 is probably not survivable against China. I also think if we were to fight Russia again, or not again, but if we were to fight Russia, if they went beyond Ukraine, I do think their tactics get better, and I don't think the MQ-9 is particularly survivable. So that's my belief, is no, we shouldn't change our thoughts on legacy assets. What do you think?
I think you're spot on there. And I think that the last thing that you said there, talking about them fighting Ukraine versus them fighting us or NATO, right? I think they went in there a little bit cocky, right? They were arrogant walking into this thing going, we got this
Hubris.
Thing.
Yep.
Yeah. And they did not approach this thinking that there was a threat. And, you know, I can only, you know, when I've looked at some of the videos that I've seen of the TB2s knocking out systems, I can only think of the maintainers that have met me at the jet when I talked about having a system that failed on an airplane after a sortie. And one of the first questions, which is a little bit insulting to your intelligence, but is completely valid, is, hey, sir, what position was the ONOFF switch in? And some of those SAM systems did not appear to be operating, which to me either says it's not working, they weren't thinking about it, or they didn't think there was a threat out there. And so they had the ONOFF switch in the OFF position, which lo and behold, that makes it really easy for a, you know, completely observable, low speed, you know, pretty simple drone to roll in there and drop a weapon on it. And I think that's an important thing to take into account. The other thing, and going back to that idea of hubris, you said it better than I did, standard getter, is, you know, it's the Tui Spats quote, which is, we better be prepared to dominate the skies above the surface of the earth, or be prepared to be buried beneath it. And I think in this case, they weren't prepared to dominate the skies because they thought, we got this. And I think they got that wrong.
A Tui Spats quote. Wow. Outstanding. Nice preparation for this. Okay. Next, Air Force Baylor Bearer. And for whatever reason, my Twitter handle is overrepresented with Baylor fans. I don't know why that is. But anyways, Air Force Baylor Bear asks, why is Russian seed or suppression of enemy air defenses ineffective? So let me just take the first hack at this. I covered it a lot in the first episode. And if you haven't listened to that, feel free to go back. I explain why I think they failed in the first 72 hours. They did not launch enough anti-radiation missiles. They did not use enough non-kinetic effects. They didn't jam. They didn't take out communications. They didn't hit command and control. They did not send these systems autonomous, so that they have to operate on their own, and then they get killed. So I think they didn't have much of a seed plan. I also think and some of my Viper buddies disagree with me when I say what I'm about to say here. But the hunting and killing of modern long-range SAMs like the S-300, S-400, systems like it, I think is a unique part of SEED that needs to be dealt with almost a little bit differently. You need to have a really good plan for how you're going to find these mobile, incredibly deadly long-range SAM systems and get them off the battlefield before everybody moves forward. I don't think there was a plan for that on night one. The S-300s are still up and operating after 3 weeks. That's a crime. That is a crime of operational planning that is getting people on the Russian Air Force killed. And I'm not with the Russian Air Force. That's probably a good thing from my perspective. Hashtag I stand with Ukraine. But professionally, I'm offended by how bad they've done SEED. I know you're primarily an Eagle and Raptor guy, so you probably have a trouble spelling SEED. But what is your thoughts on why Russia has been so effective in suppression of enemy air defenses?
Or ineffective, probably being a better
term.
Did
I say effective?
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
No, it's all good, brother. I think the time that you have the best opportunity to suppress the enemy air defense is when you have the highest level of SA, you understand how they're communicating, You understand all the pieces and parts of the puzzle, where things are, what's going on. You have the best situational awareness, SA, that you could possibly have of that fight. And I think when they didn't do these things on night one, and then they stirred up the hornet's nest, at that point in time, everything becomes unpredictable. It's harder to figure out how they operate. And, you know, credit, huge credit to the Ukrainians. They have figured out this game of being hard to chase, being hard to figure out, being everywhere at all times and armed, you know, and that's actually a really valid defensive plan against somebody who's got a greater capability. And I think that once that initial nugget of, we know where Ukraine has their systems, we know how they talk, we know all these pieces and parts of the puzzle, that ability to apply a great suppression of enemy air defense plan goes away. And now everything becomes a pickup game where if you're good at doing it, like some of our, you know, our compatriots have been throughout our career, they can do that game. But the best thing to do is get as much of that out of the way when you know the most. And that was night one.
Yep. You don't get a second swing at night one. They blew it and now they are on the back foot. And I think they're going to struggle with seed throughout. If, and we'll talk about it in a minute, if they get some more S-300s, I think that just complicates things for them as well. All right. So the next kind of part of this, let's evaluate options for expanded U.S. involvement. I said it right at the beginning. You and I are not advocating one way or the other for expanded U.S. or NATO involvement. However, one of the things that I've seen that is, I'll say, frustrating is that some of the discourse in the public domain has been unnuanced, would be the nicest way that I could say it. As much as I love President Zelensky's speech, but at the end, that incredibly powerful video, but when it says close the skies, that phrase makes me cringe a little bit because it makes it sound like we as Air Force operators can flip a switch and we've closed the sky. That's not how it works. It involves a lot of planning and honestly, a lot of killing of either people or equipment. And that's a policy decision. And if the administration and NATO make that decision, then fine, we'll execute it. However, people need to understand what goes on into implementation of something like that option. And we'll talk about some other options. So I think what Zeus and I want to do, and I'm speaking for myself, but I think you're probably of the same mind, is I'd like to have a little bit more of a nuanced discussion. Let's talk about some of these options. What would be required and what are some of the escalation risks? Should not be taken that we should do something or shouldn't. It's just a more informed discussion. So with my disclaimer, anything that you wanted to say on that front before we get into the specific options?
Nope, I'm right there with you. Lockstep.
All right. Let's talk about the no-fly zone. And there are three no-fly zones as I've heard them. The first one is one that I think we can chuckle our way through. That's the non-kinetic no-fly zone. The next would be the full Monty or the whole no-fly zone, the true close the skies. And then the third, and let me just Roger up, my think tank has been leading the way on this, is the humanitarian no-fly zone. And I do want to spend some time talking about that, a lot of time talking about that. So let's start with, first off, what is a no-fly zone? Just generally, let's not get into the different types of them. So Zeus, you fly the aeroplane. What do we mean when we say a no-fly zone?
Historically speaking,
because the name doesn't really give it away. Like, I don't know just from hearing it. Anyway, sorry.
No. Historically speaking, it's a scenario in which we positively identify everything that's flying over a certain geographic area. And if it's not something that's acceptable to fly, then we either knock it out of the sky or we make it run away before it has a chance to do whatever it intended to do. And there are examples of that in the former Yugoslavia, in Iraq, in both Northern and the Northern Watch and Southern Watch, as well as over Libya historically, that we use to help build out that definition, because words do mean things.
Yeah. And Northern and Southern Watch are really important. And for those of you that aren't familiar, after Desert Storm, The Air Force, and let me use that Air Forces because it was a joint operation, never left Iraq. They flew combat sorties over Iraq every single day from 1991 through the invasion in 2003. And that more than a decade, those 12 years were flying no-fly zone operations. Northern Watch was over a certain northern latitude and Southern Watch, southern latitude. And part of that was because they had been using aircraft against their own people. So we did that at certain times. We actually destroyed aircraft in the air that violated that. We also destroyed surface-to-air missiles that were operating underneath the no-fly zone. So the no-fly zone can be pretty effective, and I certainly understand the desire to close the skies, right? You see aircraft and missiles are raining down death and destruction, especially in the indiscriminate format that is happening right now. And it's tough not to say do more, right? US and NATO, you can close the skies, do it. So that's the no-fly zone. So let's dispense with the one that I think is the least logical, which is the non-kinetic no-fly zone. We've been hearing, and I thought initially it was just one comment, but even yesterday I saw some more comments from folks saying we don't need to actually kill stuff. We can just use non-kinetic, either electromagnetic pulses or jamming or whatever to block the skies. Originally, we were going to have a third guest who couldn't make it, Tabby, and she was on one of our previous ones, and I really wanted to cue it up to her because I thought she would have a really clever way of shooting down the non-kinetic no-fly zone. But in honor of Tabby, I will simply say that's ludicrous. There is no electromagnetic pulse that's going to keep stuff from flying, short of, you know, the death and destruction of a nuclear weapon that typically is associated with it. We don't have jamming or electronic warfare equipment that are going to keep the adversaries' air and missiles grounded. There is no easy button for non-kinetic effects that would allow a non-kinetic no-fly zone. Zeus, you got anything that you want to say on non-kinetic no-fly zone? Well, I have a decent rip of my bourbon here.
No, so the only thing I'll add is we are definitely growing, you know, not only just in our military, but globally growing in non-kinetic capabilities. There are a lot of things that people are working on, but we're just not there yet, right? I wish there was a way for us to just say magically we could do this, because it would make this problem so easy to solve in some ways, portions of this problem. But if I could keep all the airplanes on the ground, then why not non-kinetically shut down all the tanks, mortars, artillery, you know, you name it that they're being used out there. And the bottom line is we're just not there yet, you know, and I applaud the people who are dreaming big on this one, but at the same time, I just go, I don't have the magic server pixie dust to make that one go away.
We don't have that capability right now. So moving on from that, let's talk about the no-fly zone over the whole country or over the capital of Kyiv. The one thing that I like to say is you do not just establish a no-fly zone, you have to enforce a no-fly zone. A no-fly zone is an act of war. You would be saying that another country, in this case Russia, you cannot fly over Kyiv, and if you do, or whatever area the no-fly zone would be, if you do, we're going to shoot you down. If we were to establish a no-fly zone over Kyiv or the entire country, it would result in U.S. or NATO aircraft shooting down Russian aircraft, and there's obviously an escalation risk there. Typically, a no-fly zone, you're going to be putting your aircraft up in a very high-risk area. You're probably going to have to destroy some ground-based air defense assets. That means dead Russians and destroyed equipment. All of that certainly risks escalation. Doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. It just means that we go in with eyes wide open on what that would mean. So let me hand it over to you, Zeus, on a full, you know, whole hog no-fly zone over either the capital or all of the country. What are some of the things that we need to be thinking about of the feasibility of this? How would we do it? And what is the risk of escalation?
You know, I think there's a theme through this thing, which is air superiority, right? And it makes sense for the Air Minded podcast, but the reality of it is, you know, I actually go back. I think a lot about this. My very first combat sortie, 1999, young Lieutenant Zeus.
God, you're so old.
I know, dude. Let me move my walker.
You were almost a Cold Warrior once and again. But wow. Anyways.
Yeah, but you know, it's a night sortie. I am on my way into Southern Watch in Southern Iraq. And I actually get off the tanker. I put my night vision goggles down and immediately I see people shooting at me everywhere, to which I just put my night vision goggles back up and go, it's a lot more comfortable when you can't see them shooting at you. But the reality of this is, I think we did such a good job of dominating the skies over countries that people don't think that that's still contested airspace. But the truth was, the closest pass I ever had to an SA-2 in my life was actually in Southern Iraq, where I could actually look and go, hey, that's the actual thing my intel officer showed me in my career as it went past me, right? And I could see tracers coming up after us. Now, I will say the Iraqi Air Force generally did not challenge us, much to our chagrin, because we were ready to manage that. But it was still contested airspace. From 1991 until 2003, they were shooting at us, we were shooting back, and that was a constant fight. And if you fast forward into the no-fly zone over the former Yugoslavia, we actually had somebody that got shot down over, you know, over the former Yugoslavia, right? And fortunately, we picked that individual up, but that doesn't mean there's not a fight. So we have to establish air superiority, which means we have to both suppress enemy air defenses in this scenario to make sure that the Russians can't shoot us down. Remember, some of their modern long-range SAMs are sitting in Belarus and are sitting in Russia, right? And that's a problem in itself. In addition to that, we have to be able to knock down all the airplanes that are out there. And there's a lot of pieces and parts in this. And if we had to establish this, we would have to basically execute our own Shock and Awe Night One campaign to start this thing off so that we could establish.
I will say we would do a hell of a lot better than the Russians did. I will tell you that.
Well, let me caveat this, you know, and that's, dude, 100% valid, because the bottom line is
not advocating. I just want to be very clear. We're not advocating. I am saying Zeus and I and a bottle of Jack Daniels, we come up with a much better air plan than the Russians did for night one. And we don't even need, we need 4 hours and we'd be good.
Amen, dude. And I think that answer is really important, which is if somebody asks us to do it, we will do it. Let there be no doubt in anybody's mind that we will make that happen. But there's a whole bunch of discussion to be had here on, we talk a lot about risk, probability, and consequences, but we also need to talk about reward. And I did a little bit of math before rolling in tonight, but in 1 month of OIF, so the first month of Iraqi freedom, we put up 41,000 sorties, actually more than 41,000 sorties. That's publicly releasable number. By comparison, in that same month, the Russians are looking like they're probably going to get close to 6,000, and a large chunk of those sorties are actually remaining in Russia or Belarus. So there's not a lot that's going on here that is actually from the air. And so on the reward side of the house, yes, could it make things better? But the question that I think leadership is talking through and kind of going back to, what does it take to do this? At what cost, right? And that's up to them to decide. But I go, we can do it. But they're working through those challenges, which is it's just not automatic. We did have somebody shot down. And generally speaking, no-fly zones are the result of somebody surrendering. You think about this, in both the former Yugoslavia and Iraq were instances in which that was a part of their terms of surrender. And they still shot at us.
Yeah. Also, the bulk of the killing, as I understand it, especially the indiscriminate killing that's happening right now, is ground-based systems like artillery, mortars, and rockets, multiple rocket launcher systems. That is not going to be solved through closing the sky. Some of the indiscriminate bombing, and I think we're going to see more of that as the Russian offensive is totally bogged down, that would be stopped by the no-fly zone. Some of the missiles potentially... But I don't think the no-fly zone is going to stop, the three dozen or so missiles that are flying in every day. So there's still going to be some killing, the bulk of killing will continue to happen. So I don't think that the no-fly zone solves all of the issues. The one other thing that I wanted to briefly talk about is the logistics of it all is when we say closing the sky, it's not just the fighters that you would put up over the Capitol, and you would have to man those 24/7, and you'd have to have an overwhelming amount of air power there because Russia's got a lot of air power close. And even if they don't send their fighters up every day or even at all, you still have to respect the threat. So a lot of fighters, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. Those fighters will be supported by a heck of a lot of tankers, right? There's a lot of tanker gas. There is the airborne intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance and command and control platforms. There are all of the people back CONUS, continental U.S., or forward deployed that would be exploiting some of that intelligence. You have folks on the ground. I mean, you're talking about a huge logistical operation. It's not as simple as saying, hey, we've got some F-15Cs that are still at Lake and Heath. We're about to take those out of service. Let's go ahead and send them to close the skies. As much as I wish we could do that and hit the easy button, that's not the case. You're talking about a huge air operation that would probably look pretty similar to a full-up air campaign. Just even if Russia doesn't fly, at least in the first few days, would have to look like basically what the air campaign would look like. Any thoughts on that front?
No, I think you're spot on. And I think geography is really important to talk about there. You know, in Allied force, the Grim Reapers shut down the air over Kosovo, but that's tiny. We're talking about a country that is actually bigger than Texas. It's the largest country in Europe. And the amount of logistical tail to establish a no-fly zone over that large of a geographic area is not insignificant. And that's really a good point you made.
Yeah. Okay. So no-fly zone is fraught. And at least what we're hearing right now from the administration and from NATO capitals is that is kind of off the table right now. Something that's been getting a lot of discussion is a humanitarian no-fly zone. And at least the thought as it has been laid out to me and General Breedlove, the former Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, is one of the main folks that's pushing this. So it's not like it's, you know, some wackadoos. There are some very serious people talking about this. It is establish humanitarian corridors in the far west part of the country, maybe around Lviv, around the border with Poland. You have humanitarian assistance camps along the border, and then you protect those with their assets. And you say, you know, and pick the latitude, longitude, I never remember, whatever, but part of the country, we say, beyond this, Russia, you're not flying. We're not going to attack you, but you don't come in here. We're just protecting the humanitarian corridors. There's a lot to like about this idea because you say, we're telegraphing that it's not offensive. Maybe there's not going to be shooting. And it's to alleviate just some of the humanitarian catastrophe. All of that sounds good. So let's get into it. And I'll have some specific questions, but anything you want to say, just as I've laid out the humanitarian no-fly zone, as I understand it, as I understand what General Breedlove is advocating, any thoughts that you have, Zeus, on this idea?
I think the important thing is that all of the scenarios that include the terms no-fly zone require a lot more lift than I think a lot of people who use those terms. And I'm not saying General Breedlove doesn't understand that, but I do think there are a lot of people in this discussion who may not realize that it's not as simple as it might sound.
Yeah.
That said, I also want to make sure that everybody, you know, I will voice this. We as the United States want to do everything we can. And you've said it before, dude, I stand with Ukraine as well. Right. And we as a country are doing that, and NATO is doing that. And actually pretty much everybody except for the tiny coalition of the willing, which is like four countries and Russia right now, are standing with them. And we want to do everything we can to help them. But there's a lot of complexity in that issue. There's a lot of questions that need to be had about what are the actual threats to those locations and what is the best way to solve that problem from a operational, tactical, strategic perspective?
So a couple of things that I will say on this front. It would work if Russia agreed. I don't necessarily know why Vladimir Putin would agree to that, nor do I trust him as far as I could throw his diminutive KGB ass. I don't trust him. It would be better if we could get some agreement there and say it's humanitarian. I don't see why he would do that. If we said we were going to, let's say, fly humanitarian supplies into Lviv, a C-17 full of baby formula looks the same on the outside as a C-17 full of Stingers and Javelins, which is, I think, what his perspective would likely be. The other thing, and I don't want to drag this down into a discussion of rules of engagement, is you have to have really clear rules of engagement. How far away from Lviv would you destroy a Russian aircraft? Do you let Ukraine fly under your humanitarian no-fly zone? Because then you're sort of escorting Ukrainian aircraft. And boy, that starts to sound a little bit like you're engaging in combat operations with the Ukrainians. It's doable. Like anything, you know, I think it's doable. I think if it happens, there needs to be a lot of thought about how we telegraph to the Russians what we're doing, really clear rules of engagement as to what Russia can do and can't, and when we would be willing to engage their aircraft. And then the last thing I will say, and you mentioned surface-to-air missiles in Belarus. I did a very simple Google Earth range and bearing tool from where the open press says the S-400s are, the SA-21, just outside of Brest, Belarus, and it's within the maximum range of Lviv. So what you're talking about is some of our aircraft flying within the lethal radius of the most dangerous Russian surface-to-air missile system. We definitely don't want to destroy that, right, in this humanitarian no-fly zone. But boy, I would struggle as the intel officer briefing you, Zeus, as you're about to go out the door of, hey, don't worry about that SA-21 that's going to keep showing up on the display. Yeah, he's going to be there and probably looking at you, but we think Putin's going to tell him not to shoot. There are some concerns there. So anyways, there are logistical concerns I have. That doesn't mean it can't be done, and it's certainly not anything that I'm advocating one way or the other. It's just a very nuanced conversation needs to happen. I'll give you the last word if there's anything else you want to say on the humanitarian no-fly.
I think this will apply to the humanitarian no-fly, and I'll throw this out there for all of them. But there's one challenge that I think we forget about in this one. We just gave them thousands of Stingers, right? And for me, right? For me to enforce a no-fly zone, for anybody to do that, you're going to have to be able to fly down to the surface up to 60,000 feet, right? You're going to be all over the sky. But we just handed a Stinger to a whole bunch of people that might not know the difference between what a Raptor, a Viper, an Eagle, fulcrum, you know, a frog flanker, feet,
yeah.
A flanker, you know, like any of those
frog foot like, or frog feet, right?
But they don't know what those look like, and you got to take that into account. Friendly fire, now that this has turned into a muddled mess, is a very real possibility, and it's important for us to remember that, because we're passing out systems to these guys like candy, and as we should, right? I'm not saying, but who knows where those things are in that country right now? And honestly, if I'd been getting bombed for a week straight and saw something flying by that I thought I could reach out and touch with a Stinger, you better believe I would let them have it, right?
Absolutely.
Regardless of whether that was somebody enforcing a humanitarian no-fly zone or a platypus looking Su-34.
And the Su-30 looks quite a bit like the F-15, especially from the ground and the non-visual recognition experts. I did miss, as I'm looking at my notes, I missed one question from at Lance A. Wilkins, who asked, how would a no-fly zone fail or escalate compared to OSW or ONW? He's an Eagle guy. And I think, as I recall, he flew in one or both of those missions or those operations. And Zeus, I think we kind of already talked about it. Was a little bit different in that we already had Saddam had capitulated and we still did shoot, but it didn't escalate. So I think the answer is kind of already there, but anything that you wanted to add on escalation risk of this operation potential vice OSW and ONW.
No, I think we hit those key points. It's a shout out to Blade, because I might have flown once or twice with that guy.
Okay.
But I think the key piece is, one case, we had a country that had already capitulated that we had largely dismantled. In the other case, we have a country that is still in the fight and has the ability to fight back way more than did the Iraq at that time.
The Iraq. I love it. This one, I haven't been hearing as much of late, but certainly when I came up with the notes for this, the transfer of 3 squadrons of A-10s to Ukraine. Let's just roll this up in anything that Ukraine doesn't fly right now, F-16s, A-10s, whatever. I'm just the intel nerd that briefs you guys before you step to the jets. So let's just have you handle this. What would be the complications of handing Ukraine aircraft that they don't already operate?
Holy smokes, dude. Like, you got to have the ability to employ an airplane in your autonomous thinking, right? The switch movements, the pieces and parts of that equation, when you are flying an airplane, you want your fingers, your feet, your hands, you know, to all be moving automatically.
And oh, you're talking brain, Kahneman's system one, system two thinking, right?
Amen. 100%. That's exactly where I was going with that one. And you want that to be automatic so that you're making decisions on the battlefield. You know, I've got a great analogy, or not analogy, but a great story about this one, which is I flew, you know, a decade of Eagles, a decade of Raptors. And then when I got to be the old man commanding a wing, they're like, hey, fly an F-16. I got four shorties in an F-16 and was told you are now qualified in this airplane. And to be honest with you, if you asked me to take off on sortie five and go fight in a combat zone, I probably would take off and land. I'd probably survive, but I'm pretty sure I would not be able to get a single weapon off of that airplane because I was still dealing with the negative transfer of the F-22 to the F-16. And it's not that easy. You're talking probably in a best case scenario, months of training. And now the question is where are we training them? How are we training them? Who's training them? You know, there's a lot of that equation. And oh, by the way, by the time that they actually have gotten to the point where you go let that massive convoy north of Kyiv have it, well, the war's over at that point in time. Man, I would love to see a few A-10s. I was actually having a beer with a buddy of mine recently, a hog guy, and was asking, how long would it take you guys to let it go? And you could see him salivating. Like, he's just like, I would destroy that thing. But the reality is, those guys aren't our A-10 pilots, and they're not going to be in any short order.
Yeah. And also there's something to be said. The layout of the fighters that they're flying are totally different than what we do. The Soviets, when they built the aircraft that they continue to fly, and the Russians now, totally laid out their cockpits differently. They didn't believe in hands-on throttle and stick the way that we did. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily a bad way to employ the airplane, but boy, it would be completely different to fly even the A-10. So yeah, I think we can move on from that. It would be a little bit too much training. Plus, are you going to take their pilots off of the line to train? Are you going to give them a couple of Zoom lessons during the day as they're in between their three sorties? It's a nice idea. And boy, when we see that 40-mile convoy, we go, boy, it would be awesome to have a few hogs out there. But let's move on from that. This is one, Elliot Ackerman, who's a best-selling author, co-author of 2034 with Admiral Stavridis. And also, it should be noted, a former Marine with 5 combat deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. So not just a talking head. This is a guy who's done it. He argued a couple of weeks ago in Time magazine to establish a squadron of U.S. pilots flying for the Ukraine Air Force. And he uses a lot of history. And actually, I got the chance to talk to him about it before he published in Time magazine. And he's like, he started with his pitch of, I want to tell you about some brave Americans who flew with France in World War I before the U.S. was in there in an organization called the Lafayette Escadrille. And I'm like, hey, man, I host a air-minded podcast. Like, I know the Lafayette Escadrille. He talked about the Flying Tigers of World War II. There were also international squadrons that flew in the Battle of Britain that were known as Eagle squadrons, not the F-15, but they were known as Eagle squadrons. So there's a lot of history of aircrew from non-combatant countries flying for a combatant country. So as Ackerman laid it out in Time magazine, basically the theory would be DOD and other organizations in NATO capitals would either give their active duty members a year off of active duty to go fly for the Ukrainian Air Force, or have the State Department give authorization for our retired military pilots to go fly for the Ukrainian Air Force. There's talk about Americans, a lot of Europeans, a lot of people are going over to Ukraine to fight right now. So Zeus, I want to go over to you early on, probably in the first couple of days. You sent me a text message that I laughed about at the time and said, man, if I had 8 Raptors over there, I think I could create some momentum for the Ukrainians, which I found really funny. I know Zeus Fessler himself would love to be over there behind one of those beautiful blue Ukrainian Su-27s. There's probably a little bit more to it. what's your thoughts about this idea of establishing a squadron of U.S. pilots to fly for the Ukrainian Air Force?
Yeah, first, you brought a tear to my eye. I'm sitting here in my basement bar looking at a book that's called Horses Don't Fly, right next to a book called Lafayette Escadrille. Right,
I'm sure I have that same Lafayette Escadrille right over my shoulder book.
Yeah, yeah. And I love it. Right, it is near and dear to my heart. I am so frustrated by what's happening there, and would love to be able to go let the Russians have it on behalf of the, you know, like, I don't think there's a single warrior out there in our shoes that doesn't go, yeah, I could go solve this. Right, that's what we do. That's what we believe. But I go back to the training discussions we had earlier. I go back to the challenges that we're talking about in this thing. And dude, I can't go fly a flanker tomorrow for Ukraine and be effective with it.
That's a really important point. And you're a guy, you said, a decade of flying the Eagle, decade of flying the Raptor, 2 years of trying to fly the Viper, well over 2,000 hours, including combat hours. There's probably not many people who do it better than you. You're saying right now, you could not, maybe you could turn the keys of a Su-27 and get it to take off. You're not going to be an expert at employing the aircraft.
Amen. And I think there's a really important comparison to make between what our airplanes do now and what they did back then. Back then, I had to teach you how to deal with the aerodynamic effects of the airplane, how to not get it out of control, how to max perform it, and how to make sure that you understood how the gun sight in front of you worked. Now you're talking about hundreds of switches and buttons in a foreign language with a completely different set of honestly, I think about it, but my paradigm of how U.S. fighters work and how Russian fighters work, it doesn't easily transfer. So now, instead of thinking about decision-making, I'm thinking about which switch do I find in this cockpit right now to make the thing do that I, you know, do what I want it to do. And I think that complexity makes this viable in a long-term fight, right? It's possible if there was a long amount of time, but we're talking about months to be able to work through that, to get somebody to the point where they'll be effective on that battlefield, or in the battle space is probably a better term. And we're not there. I don't think we're there. Even if we started tomorrow, by the time we got them there, got them trained, everything else, they're going to be in the fight a couple months from now. My question is what airplanes are they training on?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. The last major policy proposal that has been out there that has really angered folks because of the fact that it seems to be dead now is the Polish MiG-29 to Ukraine deal. So let me just give a little bit of background and then we'll discuss. So from basically the first couple of days, there had been talk about resupply of the Ukrainian Air Force with aircraft from NATO countries that fly FSU, former Soviet Union aircraft. And there's a pretty good report that air-to-air missiles have already been sent to Ukraine as a resupply. So the thought was, all these NATO countries that fly MiG-29s or Su-27s or Su-25 frog feet, they're all planning to get rid of them to fly U.S. or other NATO aircraft, and they're already getting these out of service. So why don't we help that process along? And at least as the plan was kind of laid out, Poland has all of their MiG-29s and their Su-25s. They send them, or they transition them over to the Ukrainian Air Force, and then we backfill by giving them some F-16s. Makes a lot of sense, right? They get rid of some of the platforms they already get rid of. They increase their combat capability because they have U.S.-built Vipers that are interoperable with the rest of NATO. We're helping them out with where they already want to be with their national defense strategy, and we keep the Ukrainians in the fight. There's a lot good to that. At least when Poland, and this gets a little bit weird because how much the State Department knew or don't know, I don't know. Poland eventually, the Polish, I believe, foreign minister said, we're going to transfer all of our MiG-29s to the Americans. We're going to send them to Ramstein Air Base, and then they can give them to Poland, or excuse me, they can give them to Ukraine. She's like, whoa, okay. So anyways, that's right now, as I understand it, that deal is dead. As of a couple of days ago, a DOD official on background, they do these background reports every day, said that Ukraine is down to 56 combat aircraft and they're flying only about 5 to 10 sorties a day, which says, oh man, maybe we should do something like this. So Steve Trimble of Aviation Week, he is at the DEW line. He's a great Twitter follow. Like, smash the follow button right now on Twitter for Steve. He asked, is your assessment of how what is your assessment of how donated MiG-29s might contribute to Ukrainian air power? So what do you think? If they've got 50 some odd aircraft left, would 24 more MiG-29s help them?
You know, the question you're asking is a great question. And I wish I had, you know, I'm going to say this one right off the bat. I wish I had more information, right? And when I say that, how do they support them, right? Do they have the capacity to support those? Or are we doing this whole thing to get those airplanes there and they can't be maintained? I'll go back to the technical aspects of it, which is I'm pretty sure the Polish did their own upgrades to their MiG-29s.
And that is out in the open press. They have a more upgraded MiG-29 and different upgrades than the Ukrainians do. I think we're safe to say that.
Yeah. So the question on that is, how long would it take to get the Ukrainian pilots, and where do you do that up to speed in that airplane? There are just so many factors in this thing that I think the discussion is really the standard risk versus reward. And so, you know, I'm not going to calculate that for it. That's a political leader decision on that risk versus reward. But those are the factors that go in that, which is, how long is it going to take? How do we actually achieve this? What do we think that the added benefits are? What do we think the potential regrets are associated with this? And I think we've talked through all the factors that go into that. And I get it. If I were Volodymyr Zelensky, I would hope I did as
who
well
is
as
awesome,
he did.
By the way, yeah. Can we just say that for a minute?
Without a doubt, right? Like there is, I would hope I would do as well as he would in that scenario, because that dude has just absolutely stepped up. But that said, I would be asking for everything on the planet. And it's up to the leadership of all these other countries to figure out, how do they want to do this? What's the best way to do this? What provides the best reward? What supports long-term strategic objectives? And what are all the pieces of this equation? And ultimately, there are reasons why I could see it's helpful. There are reasons why I could see it doesn't help much. There are challenges to this. There's all these pieces. And the one thing that I do know, that in my heart of heart, I believe, is that from the Ukrainian perspective, when you see your own fighters flying over your country, that is a massive, massive morale builder, right? And I think that might be his perspective more than anything in this thing, which is, I just need to keep going. But I fully expect him to ask for everything out there and know that he's not going to get all those pieces and parts necessarily. And there's a big technical discussion, and more importantly, a geopolitical discussion behind that.
And I do think it's important. So I think, so the administration took a big hit from a lot of people for not allowing that to come through, but they did announce 800 million more of security assistance, well over now 2 billion over about the last 8 months in security assistance. And some of the pieces and parts were announced yesterday. There's a lot of really important stuff that is being sent. So Steve Trimble asked a follow-up that I'll start with and then hand over to you. And he said, would Ukraine be better off with used S-300 and Buk M1s, those would be an SA-11, than the used MiG-29s from Poland? And reporting indicates maybe at least the Slovakian S-300 is going to go over there. So let me start by saying, I put out an article just today for the Atlanta Council that said, you know, basically, let's not lose the forest for the trees here. The MiG-29s would be nice, but if those don't happen, there's five capabilities that I think are maybe even more important than the MiG-29s right now. Just generally, they would be anti-tank capabilities, things like the Javelin and the British NLAW that are just destroying Russian armor. The second would be air defense. And to get to Steve's point, the S-300 is doing awesome work right now. Stinger is doing awesome work. If we can get some of those S-300s, and it sounds like we are, from the former Soviet countries that are in NATO, if they send them those over, and it's Bulgaria, it's Greece, it's Slovakia, if those get sent, that's great. More Stingers, that's great as well. The third major area that I think is really important is UAVs and drones. The UAVs, we've already talked about the TB2. That thing's awesome. It is not the TB-12, as I often screw up and say it's the TB-2. And then kamikaze drones like the Switchblade that we talked about earlier would be really important. The next that I think is super important is counterfire capabilities. Ukraine's got to be able to find those artillery pieces, those rocket launchers that are destroying commercial or residential buildings. More radars, more rocket launchers would be great. And then the last would be anti-ship capabilities, especially if they're going to try to do any kind of naval operation at or near Odessa. Some more anti-ship capabilities would be really important. So I don't want to poo-poo the MiG-29 deal. I also think it's a very visible thing that people are just glomming onto when there's a lot of other great things we are doing and can continue to do.
That list that you provided are all things that I think will help them with that problem. I think one of the challenges, and I think that everybody who's passionate about these topics and these issues and passionate about this fight, right? We haven't seen something like this in Europe since World War II, right? It is a little bit mind-numbing to see this going on right now. The answer is do something, right? Everybody starts, and it's like when you show up in a crisis, everybody yeah. says do something. But I go back always to my favorite quote from Pulp Fiction, be cool, honey bunny, right? You have to sit down. You have to calm down for a minute there and go, what are the exact right things that we can do right now to have the greatest effect in this scenario within the constraints that we have? Yeah. And I think that list actually was a great list. I'm glad you talked about anti-ship missiles, because I do think that some resources are being used looking out towards the ocean right now that the Ukrainians would rather use otherwise. And they've creatively taken out a few Russian ships. But if the Russians...
with multiple launch rocket system with MLRSs, which is crazy.
I know.
A ship kill with rocket. I love it. Yeah.
Super, super creative. And it's awesome to see what they're capable of doing. But I do think, to your point, some of those smaller weapon systems that are super ubiquitous, it's hard to figure out where they're coming from. They're out there all over the place. You have to assume they're all over the place, are actually the most bang for the buck at this point in
time. All right. This is going to be my last question for you. I already kept you longer than I intended to, but of course we started talking and got going. So I guess at the beginning of last episode, I did talk about how we were going to take a dispassionate, or how I took a dispassionate look at this air war. But, you know, I think we've both made it pretty clear we're passionate about what's happening to the Ukrainian people. But to just turn that off for a minute and just to look at it as military professionals, I think it's just how we do business that we always look at employment and start to critique it and start to find lessons learned. And so that's sort of what we've been talking about today. I don't think that our text chains are going to stop anytime soon. We're going to continue talking about it and what the Russians are doing. I think what we're talking about is really important. And I think it's important for not just analysis of this conflict, but honestly to get ready for what we hope is never the next conflict. I think it's important that we take lessons learned, but not the wrong lessons. I really agree with the point that you made that Russia fought this probably differently than they would fight NATO if they ever had to. They probably wouldn't have the same hubris. They would be better. I do also think we've seen that they had problems from the strategic down to the tactical level. You have to think that they will get better. War is the best way that people adapt and innovate. I think that you're going to see better employment. What we've talked about today is some ways that maybe the US and NATO might be able to help. We've evaluated those. I think in looking at them, both in the benefit and the risk, which I think is really important. So I know this is probably not going to be the last one of these that I do. I'm going to continue looking at this conflict, but I'm learning a lot, and I think it's important, at least in my profession, to try and understand what's happening and what that means for the future of air conflict or air campaigns. So that's kind of my last word. Zeus, I'm going to leave the overall last word to you.
Oh, wow. You know, first off, thank you for the opportunity to come BS about this. You know, as I've been blowing up your phone with text messages and my brother and a whole bunch of other people, you know, just talking about this, it is, I think it's something that people that dedicate their life to this business are really, really passionate about, right? And passionate yep. about it's that you don't want to see it happen. And when it does happen, how do we learn from this, get better, and make sure that it doesn't happen again? Right. And I think that's a big takeaway from this one, because this is horrific. It's frustrating, and I think we all want to see it stop as soon as possible. I think the one last thing that I'll throw out there that's important as we look at, and we've talked a lot about Russian failures in this, is that there are two things that I think haven't failed in this from the Russians. And you can see this, and it's important for us to remember this because these things matter to us, which is Putin spent a lot of money on a lot of different parts of his military over the past couple decades, right? He put money all over the place. Yeah. But if you look at the places where he spent a lot of money, where he had the most depth, it's in his nuclear force, it's in his long-range aviation, and it's in his cruise missiles or his long-range fires. And largely, long-range aviation and his cruise missiles have been very effective. And for us as United States of America's warriors, right, out there figuring out how do we make sure that our people sleep well at night, that's what we need to be thinking about. We need to think about the fact that despite the strategic, operational, and tactical failures in Ukraine, the things that are actually the most effective of us against us have been effective in this war. And we cannot stop thinking about the fact that he still has the ability to reach out and touch us here. And we need to be ready to deal with that. So I don't want us to ever take away that, hey, you know what? He got rocked in Ukraine, because there's a lot of reasons for that. But he still has the capacity to do that. And I have dedicated my life, and I know you have, and has millions and millions of other people in our country to go, and not on my watch. We're not going to let this happen to our people. And I want us to make sure we keep that front in our minds as we look at the lessons out of this.
Well, I couldn't end it any better. Zeus, it's been awesome having you on a second time. I'm sure I'll be hitting you up again. You're top of my Rolodex. Not that anybody actually has one of those anymore, but I look forward to continuing to talk about the air war with you. I hope that it ends with an ignominious defeat for the Russians very soon. And I hope that we can have a very celebratory one of these to talk about all the things that Ukraine did in the air war to ensure that the Russians had that defeat. Thanks a lot, Zeus. It's been awesome. Exactly what I was hoping to get out of this episode. Thank you very much.
Thanks, brother.
Well, that does it for my conversation with Zeus Fessler. You probably picked up that we had a blast talking about the air war. As we mentioned on multiple occasions, despite our dispassionate analysis of the war, we're really passionate about the Ukrainian cause. We want to see this over as quickly as possible, and with the end result being that Russia is out of Ukraine. As I mentioned earlier, I'll be releasing another episode in about a week or so with my Atlantic Council a compatriot, senior fellow Kelly Grieco. In the meantime, I'd love to hear what you thought of this episode. And if you have any other questions that Zeus and I didn't cover, and maybe I can get to in the next episode or episodes. I'm most active on Twitter, but you can also find me on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn as @airmindedpod. Or you can just email me directly, airmindedpodcast@gmail.com. As a reminder, the positions expressed by Zeus and I are ours alone, and they do not reflect the official position of the United States Air Force, the Department of Defense, and or any, and any, ugh. You know, I usually cut this. I'm thinking about leaving it. It doesn't reflect the official position of the United States Air Force, the Department of Defense, or any other governmental organization. Thanks again for listening in. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Until next time, thanks for downloading and listening to the Air Minded Podcast.